This is
KUT.
KUT, Austin.
Stop.
This is KUT Weekend for the second weekend of August 2020. Thank you for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5, the NPR station in Austin, Texas. Here's what we got for you this week. Austin's largest school district delays classes to prepare for the virus.
We will have in-person and it'll be a phased-in approach.
Election officials get creative in their search for safe polling sites in Texas.
A lot of the owners of the facilities we want won't give us an answer for sure that we can or cannot use the facility.
And Austin Country Flea Market now on the brink of closure.
There are lots of places in Austin that are valuable to the Latino community that sometimes just disappear without notice.
Those stories and more in this edition of KUT Weekend. But let's start with the latest on COVID-19 in Texas, because how could we not? The 7-day average of new cases started to go up a bit after coming down a bunch. So the 7-day average is around 8,000 statewide. The number of daily deaths has started coming down. Hospitalizations are slowly coming down. Still about 8,300 lab-confirmed COVID-19 patients in Texas hospitals. 8,300. Overall, things are trending the right way for the most part, but it is still bad. The virus is still spreading out of control and killing hundreds of people a day statewide. On Thursday alone, more than 300 deaths were reported. So here's Governor Greg Abbott.
The numbers of COVID-19 are going down from an elevated level. We are not at all anywhere close to being in a safe situation of COVID-19. People need to understand that just because COVID-19 numbers are improving in this region does not mean that COVID-19 has suddenly left the Dallas-Fort Worth area or the state of Texas or the United States of America. It still exists. And it can still transmit at the same rate that it has been able to in the past. What people in the Dallas-Fort Worth area need to know is that the reason why COVID-19 is spreading less today than it was in the middle part of July or the latter part of June is because people in this region have been far more responsible in the way they conduct their daily lives. People have almost uniformly adopted the practice of wearing a mask.
Here in Austin, the city's top doctor says he's worried people may be backsliding when it comes to COVID-19 precautions. KUT's Andrew Weber reports.
Dr. Mark Escott told Travis County Commissioners there are three indicators in last week's cases that have given him pause. For one, the number of new cases has increased at a fast clip in the last couple of days. On top of that, new hospital admissions have plateaued, and the doubling time for the virus has dropped from 55 days down from the 70s last week. The good news, testing capacity has increased, and Escott says Austin Public Health may soon open up more testing to asymptomatic patients.
We're working with our testing algorithm so that we can offer those tests to folks who may not have been able to get it before due to the fact that we had such a high flow of individuals who were symptomatic.
Ahead of schools reopening, Escott said he's concerned about the positive test rates among 10 to 19-year-olds. Andrew Weber, KUT News.
The Austin Independent School District is delaying its first day of classes until September 8th. KUT's Claire McInerney reports the school board voted on the change last night in response to COVID-19.
The district said they are pushing back the first day of class because Austin Public Health has recommended schools stay closed to stop the spread of COVID-19. Delaying the start also gives teachers more time to plan virtual lessons and get more Wi-Fi hotspots and computers to students who need them. The board also decided to ask the state to extend its window for virtual learning. Right now, school districts are allowed to do virtual learning for the first 4 weeks of the school year and still receive state funding. AISD will ask for that option to do virtual learning for 4 additional weeks. Superintendent Paul Cruz said the district could start bringing students back into school buildings during that second 4-week period.
We will have in-person and it'll be a phased-in approach. And we still have to provide in-person instruction for students who do not have access to technology.
All employees, including support staff, will still get paid even with the adjusted calendar. Claire McInerney, KUT News.
And another school district in Central Texas is out with its plans on how to resume classes, taking a different approach. KUT's Donnie Matias reports on what on-campus instruction will look like in the Marble Falls Independent School District.
In-person learners at Marble Falls ISD will start school August 19th. Those students are expected to be screened for COVID-19 symptoms at home before arriving to school each day. All students and staff must wear face coverings on school buses and in school buildings. Teachers will provide students with an hourly mask break. Marble Falls ISD says all classrooms will be disinfected daily, including frequently touched areas like restrooms and playgrounds. Hand sanitizers will be available at all entrances and exits. Parents or guardians won't be allowed to walk students inside campus buildings. They must also wait in their vehicles during dismissal. Remote learning begins August 21st. Dani Matias, KUT News.
And there's another virus that we will have to be concerned about soon. The flu season starts in about 8 weeks, usually around the beginning of October. Here's Austin Public Health Director Stephanie Hayden on that.
Last year was a very difficult year for Travis County with flu cases. And if we combine an increase of flu cases and COVID-19, we are definitely going to overwhelm all of our systems.
Also this week, we heard from officials at the University of Texas at Austin about their back-to-school plans. Classes resume August 26th. And UT Austin, of course, is the biggest educational institution in Central Texas. More than 50,000 students, plus another 3,000 teachers, more than 10,000 staff. AISD technically is bigger, but this is mostly contained to one geographic location. So UT Austin's interim president, Jay Hartzell, says about half of students, 45 to 50%, will be taking classes entirely online when the semester starts August 26th.
So that we think is encouraging. We're happy with that mix of courses for our students. Those numbers are largely reflecting student choice. Students are opting whether to sign up for more of the hybrid or in-person classes or more of the online classes. And when that reduction in density in our campus is combined with our various safety measures and our testing measures, we think and believe this is going to create a safer campus for everybody.
A big part of UT's plan is to test asymptomatic people on campus. They bought 3 new testing machines that can do about 100 tests a day with a 15-minute turnaround time on results. So that's supposed to speed up contact tracing and reduce the need for long self-isolation in some cases. And then UT is contracting with labs to conduct up to 5,000 tests a week. In-person voting will likely still be the main way that Texans cast their ballots during the upcoming presidential election. Texas is one of a few states that has decided not to expand absentee or mail-in voting during the coronavirus pandemic. So local election officials are now scrambling to find polling sites that are willing to host in-person voting. And as KUT's Ashley Lopez reports, that means officials are getting creative about where to put polling sites.
Caitlin Bainey voted during a primary runoff in Austin several weeks ago. Because Texas leaders have refused to expand the state's limited vote-by-mail program during the pandemic, many voters had to cast their ballot in person. Bainey wasn't too happy about this, but she says she voted early and there were no lines. All in all, she says, voting wasn't that bad.
Yeah, I was, you know, very impressed. Everything was very spaced out, lots of hand sanitizer, protective equipment and stuff. So I felt like as far as voting goes during a pandemic, this is as best as I could possibly imagine, you know.
Election officials in Texas are hoping to replicate this experience for voters on a much bigger scale in November. Ali Lozano with the Texas Civil Rights Project says because of COVID-19, there's a lot more that local officials have to plan for ahead of the election.
It's of the utmost importance that election administrators and county officials start preparing now for November to make sure that we have enough polling locations, enough poll workers, and that everybody knows what they need to be doing in order to make everyone feel safe.
Austin's top election official, County Clerk Dana Debevoise, has a plan to have double the amount of polling locations she had during that primary runoff several weeks ago. She says so far, finding those polling locations has been a challenge.
Because a lot of the owners of the facilities we want won't give us an answer for sure, one way or the other, that we can or cannot use the facility.
Debevoise says during a pandemic, it's pretty hard to find places that are up for having a lot of people gather on their property to vote. For example, for many years, voting at grocery stores was super popular in Austin because they were so convenient. But now, Debevoise says, the pandemic has made grocery stores a terrible place for a voting site.
There was no way to socially distance the voters, especially from the shoppers, and it was just too close, too crowded. It was never going to work.
During the recent primary runoff, Debevoise says she relied on schools as polling sites. But now that schools may be reopening at some point in the fall, they are not a reliable option for her. Chris Davis, the election administrator for Williamson County, says voting sites that cater to older voters might also not be an option this fall.
We're relatively certain we're going to take off the table nursing homes and assisted living facilities that we had used and enjoyed and the residents had enjoyed in the past as election day polling places.
Davis, who is also an official with the Texas Association of Election Administrators, says usually it's not good to switch up polling locations because it confuses voters. But now, he says, election officials are going to have to get creative. Davis says they are going to have to find new polling sites to replace many of these traditional options that are now unsafe.
And it's not going to be uniform from one county to another. They're just going to be different solutions that are going to need to come up with to kind of tailor toward their respective situations.
For example, Dana Debevoise says that she's hunting around Austin for some unusual sites, many of which are privately owned.
So we're considering all kinds of new buildings, lobbies, and amenity centers for apartment complexes, hotel ballrooms. All of those are under consideration.
The hitch here, Debevoise says, is that getting more help from the private sector means rental costs will likely be higher. Chris Davis in Williamson County says he's looking for more open-air options in an effort to keep the possible spread of the coronavirus down.
We're considering sites that we could have kind of a robust drive-through voting, say a defunct or closed bank with several teller lanes, as well as perhaps parking garages, something that can give one-stop service.
And where these new polling sites are located matters, too. Mirna Perez with the Brennan Center says election officials also have to be mindful of how voting locations are distributed within their counties.
They need to make sure that there's enough polling places in the communities that need them, especially in communities that are underserved or have low rates of vote-by-mail usage.
And the cost of not finding enough polling sites could be high for voters. Ali Lozano with the Texas Civil Rights Project says many counties are already at risk for longer lines. She says that's because the state has about 700 fewer polling sites than it did about a decade ago. And Lozano says voting during a pandemic is just going to take longer than it did in 2016.
And that's if people keep the same amount of polling locations. If we close even more and we have even less polling locations with these added steps, it's just a perfect storm for problems that is absolutely going to lead to longer lines if we do not substantively prepare now.
And if officials do find enough actual locations, the next hurdle is staffing those sites. Local officials say finding poll workers has been harder during the pandemic because historically these workers tend to be older and at a higher risk during the pandemic. In response, civic groups in Texas have made recruiting younger poll workers one of their biggest projects ahead of the election. Ashley Lopez, KUT News.
Once the public health threat from COVID-19 is reduced, how will it be possible to reopen live music venues safely? Can you even do that? Well, the city of Austin is joining a national pilot program to try and find out. And Chad Switecki with our reporting partner, the Austin Monitor, is here to talk about it. Hello, Chad.
Hi, Nathan.
What can you tell us about this partnership with the Reopen every venue safely? Best practices guide.
Well, you know, venues across the country spent the past 4 or 5 months purely just focusing on surviving and making sure that someday they might be able to reopen when and if there is a vaccine or some kind of widespread treatment. But the question is now being asked, what do they need to do from an operational standpoint to make sure that they can have their employees, their patrons, and their entertainers operating and doing their thing on the premises safely? So they're starting to look at what steps need to be taken, from just creating standard policies, from equipment, PPEs, to even doing things like getting rid of catered food and just doing takeout service for entertainers. Just those simple things that need to be done to lessen the chance of viruses being transmitted.
Right. And some of these options that you report sound kind of expensive, like upgrading airflow and filtration systems, investing in deep cleaning equipment, making restrooms as low touch as possible. These venues were already operating on pretty thin margins prior to the pandemic. How would they be able to afford this stuff?
Well, it's important to note that these aren't all must-haves, but these are all things to think about or consider that you could do. So it's kind of becomes something of a menu or a buffet of gauging out what is your appetite in terms of biting off an investment to do things like, yeah, new HVAC or redoing your bathrooms, things that are pretty capital intensive. So the folks behind this aren't saying, here's what you must do, and they're not telling you how to do it, but these are things that if you wanted to look at what all your options are, these are some of them. And so there are, you know, less expensive things like purely doing policies or just having some kind of a regimented cleaning program with sanitation equipment and wipes and whatnot, or getting a little bit more intensive with electrostatic deep cleaning equipment that is going to cost a pretty penny.
And I guess we should take a step back here and say, these are not plans that the venues are expecting to implement in the next month or two. We're talking post-vaccine.
Right. Yeah, exactly. It's kind of for the eventual day, you know, several months from now, probably sometime in 2021, when things are a little bit more safer and predictable and we can all go out without gnashing our teeth, that the venues will, in the time in between those eventualities, can start to plan out what they need to do to operate safely and just be conscientious about their business operations.
What is it going to feel like to go to a show in 2021 if there's a vaccine with all of this PPE? And I mean, are people going to be willing to go through all this stuff? What is that experience going to be like?
I mean, that's the great question, is what is people's appetite or tolerance or willingness to suit up, for lack of a better term, and for the venues to be a little bit less punk rock and dirty rock and roll. I mean, you think about like a club like New York CBGBs or heck, even Emo's back in the day on 6th Street, you know, just the, right. My God, those bathrooms, right? So you think about kind of those days are gone, probably. So you're going to have to probably be a little bit less down and dirty all the way around. And so it's going to change things without a doubt. But there's also, I think, people, once we get past having a vaccine and being able to congregate safely in meaningful ways again, I think people's appetite for getting together in kind of communal ways is going to be pretty robust. And so if that comes with having to wear a mask or, you know, having your performers up on stage stand apart from each other a little bit more and have some screening up in front of them, I guess that's a trade-off. We'll see how many people are willing to take. But I think there's going to be some adjustment. I don't know how wholesale it's going to be, but there will probably be a spectrum of clubs doing many, many different things. And so this best practices guide is presenting the entire buffet of options for precautions and safety steps to take.
Well, it's a 16-page guide, and you can actually read the whole thing by going to Chad's story about this. It's called Austin Joins National Pilot Program, Exploring How to Safely Reopen Music Venues. Find that at austinmonitor.com. Chad, I miss going to shows.
Man, you and me both, buddy.
Doing a small kindness for someone in need might seem like a simple thing, but it can leave an impression that lasts decades. And that's what happened to Zenobia Oromolye in the early 1990s. Earlier this year, we put out a call for your stories about overcoming differences, like true stories about finding common ground. We worked with the Austin Public Library and the Library Foundation. We collected these submissions and helped writers shape their stories into pieces to read for the radio. Oromolye wrote about her experience as a Black woman moving to Texas.
I'm from Chicago. I worked for an agency for several years with limited opportunities for promotion. One day, feeling restless at work, I saw 6 jobs posted for management. All of the jobs were out of state. I applied for all 6. I was stunned when I was contacted to come for an interview in Austin, Texas. I was the only applicant from out of town. 2 weeks later, I was offered the job. I accepted. The news spread like wildfire. People came to congratulate me, but with reservations. A white female director talked to me about the South and asked, did I really want to work down there? Some people asked if I was scared. Now I started to doubt my choice. I discussed it with my grandmother, who encouraged me to go, but to be very careful. I arrived in Austin in 1991. My new director gave me an overview of Texas. Some people referred to me as a Yankee, but I told them I was from the Midwest, not the East Coast. One night, I was driving home late, about 1 a.m., when my car died on I-35. I was in a panic. A red truck pulled over and parked behind my car. A white man walked slowly towards my car. He asked, in a slow southern drawl, "Miss, do you need some help?" I stammered, "No, I'm okay." He started walking away, but then turned back towards me. I was terrified. Visions of the Klan, rednecks, and racists flashed before me. He came back to the car. "Miss, it's late. How do you plan to get home? You can ride with us." I was scared and tired. I agreed and walked back to his truck. I met his wife. I gave him directions to my house and prayed. I sat in the front with them. They were friendly and drove me home. He refused to accept any money from me. He walked me to my door like a perfect gentleman. They waved goodbye and drove off. That act of kindness is something I never forgot. They were good people who helped a person in need. After all, we're all a part of the human race.
That was Zenobia Oromolye with her story for our Common Ground project. Thanks to the Austin Public Library and the Library Foundation for partnering with us on this project. And you can hear more in this series at KUT.org. The pandemic has already shuttered Austin landmarks, from music clubs to countless restaurants in the city, and it's made life more difficult to experience community safely, to connect with old acquaintances, to connect with lifelong family friends. Now, as KUT's Jerry Quijano tells us, the Austin Country Flea Market, where so many of those things come together, could be the next to fall.
The flea market, or La Pulga, is a little bit of all those things and more. It's a place where you can buy a piece of jewelry, pivot to your right, and come face to face with a colorful selection of backpacks and toys for kids, only to turn around and find aisles of tools for your next home repair. And while you're walking down the aisles, you can take in the sweet smells of roasting corn and turkey legs.
It seemed like there was always a booth with something just to interest me and help me pursue different parts of my culture.
That's Alan Garcia. He's a lifelong Austinite who runs the Instagram account ATX Barrio Archive, chronicling the history of black and brown people and neighborhoods around the city. He shares old flyers, newspaper clippings, and personal videos and photos that document part of the city's history that is becoming increasingly more replaced by gentrification and the passing of time.
A lot of, you know, long gone places, but not forgotten barrio landmarks.
Now he's worried the Austin Country Flea Market may also disappear into history. Last month, the market's owners made the decision to close it down, giving vendors a 2-week notice. Since then, they've decided to give an additional 2 weeks until the end of the month, at which point they'll reevaluate.
Because it's been just kind of existing at the fringes of the city, it's been a big immigrant space, a hangout spot for recently arrived immigrants. I feel like it's gotten less attention, but it's such an important marketplace for everyone, for families, for socializing.
For Alan, the market is a family affair. His parents immigrated from Mexico City in the 80s. At the flea market, Alan found community among the Puerto Rican family they traded recipes and stories with, as well as the vendor from Iran who worked at the market repairing computers. This exposure to a multitude of different cultures spurred Alan to work as an archivist focusing on the city's history and working-class neighborhood landmarks like the market. Alan's father, Alejandro, has been working weekends at the market since the mid-90s and says it's the perfect place to go when you don't have a clue about what to do.
The whole community goes there, not just the immigrant community. It's a mix. It's a melting pot.
Over the years, Alejandro has sold video and audio equipment as well as clothing. He says many of the families who made a living working weekends at the market brought their kids along, just like he did with Alan.
They come from small communities in Mexico where the market day is there Sunday, and they meet over there. And then you will see them with their best clothes, saying hi to everybody and buying everything they need for the week. And that custom was transplanted to the flea market.
The imminent closing is not the first dilemma the market has faced. In 2009, a fire destroyed about half of the market. Emma Hernandez has been working there since the first weekend she moved to Austin from Mexico more than 25 years ago, selling traditional Mexican clothing like huaraches, sandals. She says she lost more than $60,000 in merchandise in that fire and had to start from nothing.
A mí se me quemó todo. Todo mi puesto se quemó todo. Mi mercancía, yo perdí más de $60,000. Perdí yo, porque un peso no lo recuperé. Y tuve que levantarme de abajo de nuevo.
Now she's got 4 full trailers of merchandise. But if the market closes for good, she wonders, where does she go to sell it? She says visiting the market has become a tradition for people, and both the vendors and customers depend on this space.
Y pues necesitamos pues que sigan dejando abierto pues. Porque pues aquí ya es una tradición venir la gente a esta pulga. Ya tantos años y años. Aquí pasamos fríos, calores y de todo. Y nunca faltamos, yo nunca falto.
Anthony Garcia has been coming to the market on weekends with his family for as long as he can remember. Anthony is half white and half Latino. He was at the market last week to support some vendors and get his obligatory roasted corn.
It's a place like the Austin Flea Market where you can come and buy George Strait CDs and Grupo Mas CDs is a place where my culture is combined. My Hispanic culture and my white culture come together in a place like this. And, you know, it's important to me that we have representation for our community in Austin that has a lot of Latinos in it to have a place and space like this that's not exclusive.
He's worried about the loss of the market and the stage that has been host to countless Tejano and Norteño acts. Because of the pandemic, the flea market was shut down for 2 months in March and has not been able to host live music since returning. Many vendors said that's been hurting business since people come to the market to congregate, not just to shop. Anthony is worried that when local landmarks like the flea market close, its history will be forgotten and replaced with more condos and coffee shops.
There are lots of places in Austin that are valuable to the Latino community that sometimes just disappear without notice. And sometimes when you can bring a spotlight to them, you can change that.
Alan Garcia's ATX Barrio Archive is one of those spotlights shining on forgotten treasures. He says the Austin Country Flea Market is important for the vendors, the shoppers, but most importantly, for the cultural experience. Allen says it's painful to see more and more of that history being lost in a rapidly changing city.
The flea market always seemed like it was always going to be there for us, for our community. The idea of having to say goodbye to that is tough because it's really one of a kind. You know, losing it after 37 years of existence is going to be a huge loss to our city's culture.
The Austin Country Flea Market will be open Saturdays and Sundays from 10 a.m. until 6 p.m., at least through the end of August. Jerry Kihonel, KUT News.
That's KUT Weekend for the second weekend of August 2020. You can subscribe to this podcast at weekend.kut.org and email any questions or comments to weekend@kut.org or just ask me on Twitter. I'm at KUT Nathan. Our theme music is by RAC. Thank you for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5 and KUT.org. ¶¶